Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, with yet another exciting interview. If you want to know more about me, you can feel free to take a look at rajbalkaran.com. But more important than me is who I'm talking with today, Dr. Caleb Simmons, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Arizona, and one of the editors of this very exciting book, Nine Nights of the Goddess, about the Navaratri Festival in South Asia. So, Caleb, why don't you say hello to our audience and tell a little bit about yourself and your background?
Hello, and thanks for having me, Raj. In my background, I mean, I have a PhD in religious studies, and as you said, I'm at the University of Arizona. My training was primarily in medieval and colonial Hinduism with a focus on the goddess, which, of course, leads us directly to editing this volume. Yeah, that's about me.
Right, short and sweet and to the point. I actually, you know, for the audience sake, I actually collaborated with Caleb. We did a chapter to the book, and so I've been in touch with him since I met him in around 2011 at an American Academy of Religion conference. And so if we get rather silly on this call, you'll know why.
Yeah, it's actually the panel we met in was one that was related to this book, Uta Huskin, who's in the volume and had arranged the working group. It's like, it was actually her panel titled The Goddess and the King, where we met.
Right. I mean, it was called The Goddess and the King. This was 2011. This was the first year that I entered my PhD program. And now, X years later, I've recently published my thesis called The Goddess and the King in Indian Myth. And The Goddess and the King, I believe, was a title that you used at one point. Was it not?
I did, yeah. My PhD dissertation was also named The Goddess and the King. So it was a pretty popular title for theses, dissertations, and panels, I guess.
Well, I think in all fairness, it came to Ute and the collaborative group and myself probably after Caleb. He was probably the real The Goddess and the King. Having said that, that's probably a good point of entry in terms of, well, the goddess and the king, what is this title, or what do these themes have to do with this exciting publication? Tell us about this work.
All right, well, I can tell you from my perspective how those two terms relate to this book, because it's directly related to my work, and as I know also to yours, even though we take pretty radically different approaches. But you know, anyone who's interested in Hindu goddess traditions, even if you're interested in domestic ritual or public ritual, eventually, when you dig into the goddess tradition, eventually you're going to come across something related to Indian kingdoms, because the goddess was such an important aspect of that. So people who are interested in Indian history or in goddess traditions or in Hinduism more broadly wind up having some sort of convergence of these two terms in their work, where kings are interested in the goddess because the goddess is interested in kings. For my dissertation, I was studying the colonial kingdom of Mysore in South India and looking at the goddess Chamundeshwari and how the kings of Mysore, the warriors, related back to that goddess as a way of fashioning their kingdom. And so that led me, of course, to panels like the one that Uta Huskin had arranged at AAR, in which they were all looking at goddesses and kings in different manners. And, you know, fortunate for, you know, both myself and for you, Raj, is that Uta was so nice to invite us to a workshop on the Navratri festival, primarily focused on goddesses and kings, which then grew enormously over a few years and eventually led to this book, Nine Nights of the Goddess.
Yeah, it's been quite the journey. There's so much to say, but I really want to ask more than I want to say in this interview. For those who may not have looked at the book yet, may be interested in it, Nine Nights of the Goddess. It's obviously about this festival, this nine-night festival in the autumn. But what is it that's unique or interesting or fascinating that this book does that hasn't done before?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I think is what makes it pretty important is, you know, it's a look at this festival, Navratri, from all over South Asia, India, and Nepal, really, are the two foci. And it does something that any other book that I know of hasn't done. A lot of books have tried to sort of give a comprehensive history of, like, the textual background of Navratri or an in-depth case study of one celebration. But with this book, what we really tried to do is to give a short introduction that gives a little bit of the textual background, a little bit of the mythological background of the festival, but really to dive into this festival, which is by far, in my understanding, the most ubiquitous within the South Asian cultures, and just give a lot of different case studies that look at how this festival has been celebrated, you know, whether it's in court, whether it's in political life, whether it's in homes, by males, by females, by both, by Brahmins, by non-Brahmins, just giving a reflecting sort of the variety that this festival actually has within the South Asian context, and letting people just sort of enjoy having all these different case studies.
So the 30,000 foot view of this book is that it showcases various ethnographic case studies that dig into the vibrant life of this festival. Would you agree?
Yeah. And then of course we've got some essays like yours that deal more with textual traditions. And then like mine, which is a more historical understanding of how lineage fits into the colonial setting. But then we definitely do have those ethnographic chapters in there. So it's meant to give sort of the diversity in its broadest sense, both on methodology, perspectives, because it's, you know, this is not just a North American publication, but there's a lot of scholars from Europe who also were involved. And all of us taking different methods, different theories to sort of use that as a lens to look at this festival, which I think then produces something that's actually quite phenomenal in its breadth and in its depth at the same time.
I'd have to agree. I mean, I really, the methods and the ways in which my colleagues in this book, the ways in which they studied the festival were so very, very different than myself, sort of a lone textualist looking at it from a very different perspective, that at first glance it was surprising to collaborate in such a book. But then, having looked through the book, that's really the beauty of the book, is that there's so many different approaches. Maybe you could tell the audience a little bit about how the book is organized and how the essays are grouped.
Yeah, so with something like this, of course, that becomes an issue. You don't want to just throw in just a bunch of chapters that leaves the reader sort of meandering through a lot of different things. So myself, Moment to Saint, and Hilary Rodriguez, who were all co-editors on this project, decided to group the essays, thinking about the festival sort of as it's presented spatially. So we started off with the first section, which is Navratri in the Court, which is where both my essay and your essay, Raj, are in. It looks at the relationship, exactly like we've been talking about before, the relationship between the god and goddess and the king, and so how these two things relate. And then we transition then to sort of public displays of Navratri, not necessarily in the court, but sometimes by politicians, which is Moment to Saint's essay, other people in like the public displays that you would think of with Durga Puja. And then from that, we transitioned to thinking about the symbolism of the festival and thinking about, I think the section is called the Vratri Inside, the inner world, the spiritual world that is also encountered by devotees as they celebrate the festival. And then finally, we finish up with looking at the domestic side of Navratri, which I think is one of the most interesting sections, because it's, you know, it's sort of the farthest away from my own research, but one that I could see a very different world emerge, in which you move into the domestic sphere and see how much women Hindus, female Hindus, are actually using their homes and turning a private space into a public space and transforming the ritual in a bunch of different ways.
So this is obviously a theme I'd like to hear more about and dig into. I think it'll probably interest many of our listeners. But maybe tell us a bit more about this last section of the book. I believe it's essays, chapters 12 through 15, Navaratri at the Home, that reverses this idea of this being a public ritual. Can you tell us more about what your findings or the findings of our colleagues, or what you found interesting about this section?
Yeah, so I'll actually start with a little bit of an anecdote. Actually, just a few days ago, Astrid Zotter, who's at University of Heidelberg, sent me a link of a review from the Indian edition of this book published by Aleph Books. And it was a really sort of different review that really focused on this last section. And the context of the review was about it through the hashtag MeToo movement. And so it was a very praising review, but one that focused on these last essays to talk about women's agency, and in a way that I hadn't really thought about connecting it to the hashtag MeToo movement. And so that's it has a lot of power for helping people to, especially people in India, to think about the festival in different ways if they're not from some of these traditions. But the this transition from something that we normally think of as a private sphere within the domestic realm, within the home, which generally in those sort of like broad stereotypes of Hinduism becomes like the female sphere. We find here that this paradigm can get turned on its end. And so you have essays like by Deeksha Shivakumar, who talks about the public display in homes and how it's the home is transformed into almost like a museum space in which people come in and view it as a gallery, comment on the house. But it also gives this power to the domestic sphere by shaping it into a public area. So there's also all sorts of issues with the socioeconomic status and performing middle class, which is what you see in Nicole Wilson's essay. And then, of course, you have Bridget Lucchesi's essay, which is the final one, in which she talks about the Kanya Puja, the puja to prepubescent girls that happens in the home and outside. So there you see sort of this mirror of domestic and public. And then my PhD advisor actually is also in that section, Vasudha Narayanan, and her essay really is the perfect bridge between the first section and the last, because she talks about how in the medieval Vijayanagara Empire, the platform on which people would sit, sort of representing the medieval kingdom and its hierarchy, is actually reflected into the South Indian performance of the Kolu, where the dolls are all displayed. So you see how the domestic and the public and the private, how these actually aren't so different, but they're actually reflecting one another, and the performance of the festival itself is actually quite similar in both, just takes different manifestations.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Would you say it's overly simplistic, or would you say it's apt to consider that this being a festival about the goddess, about the feminine divine, has direct bearing on the extent to which it can be a domestic festival that's celebrated in the women's sphere?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and one that, you know, I teach a course here at U of A on women, goddesses, and power. And actually, it's based on a course that I took with the late Kathleen Erndl, in which you look at this question of Shakti, the divine feminine power, and how this relates from the goddess, who, you know, within the goddess tradition is the queen of the universe, all powerful, and that Shakti is what's invigorating, and how that connects to women who are also feminine and have Shakti within them. I'm always reminded of an essay that we use in my class by Cynthia Humes, in which she is doing field work in the Vindhya Mountains at Vindhyavasini's temple, and asked people about this connection between the Shakti of sort of human women and the goddess. And, it's interesting responses that she records there, because you would think, and most of the time, I think, my students think, that there's a direct connection between the divine feminine and human feminine, but it seems to be an assumption that's not necessarily always shared within the tradition. So, that doesn't really answer your question, but I think it becomes a complicated thing, to where some people, by emphasizing the feminine side of it, can make those connections, while others see more about the divine within the divine feminine, and see it as a broader lacuna between the goddess and women on earth. But it definitely provides a space for theological hermeneutics, in which you can really think about the connection between the domestic as being, again, stereotypes, but a feminine sphere of influence and agency, and then connecting it with the goddess. I think there's a lot of possibilities there for practitioners.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the reason I asked the question is because I think that we, most of us, myself included, would assume from the outside that, yes, well, of course, women can be empowered because this is a festival about a very powerful feminine figure that presides over the universe. And then we at some point have to come to terms with the notion that the goddess isn't a human in the way that, say, Rama was an incarnation. He walked the earth as a human, and we draw parallels on how to behave because of this incarnation on earth. But one may not necessarily draw parallels on how to engage based on how the goddess engages, or how she devises strategies to conquer the demons, or what have you. And there is this bursting of the bubble at some point. But the goddess is the goddess. She's not a human being.
Right.
And would you say that's reflected in the research or your findings?
No, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, I still think there's definitely that divide between, in the essays in the later portion of this volume, where, that it becomes a complicated question. It's difficult because, like in Lucchesi's essay, in the prepubescent girls are being worshipped as the goddess. So at that moment, they are both human and the goddess at the same time. So in that instance, of course, it's directly relatable. But then you transition to someone like Wilson's essay, in which looking at sort of the performance of the festival as a way to also enact social mobility, then you don't see it as much, even though you do see references there to like the goddess and femininity. So it's, I think it's an ever-present idea, right? The goddess is a woman, is feminine, but they're, it oscillates between the nearness and the farness of how that relates to human women.
Hmm. Very, very interesting theme. Would you be able to comment? I realize this is a different sort of book and that it's a collected volume, and you're not obviously a single author, so you're looking at, and I think you're doing a brilliant job of tying in all of these various voices. But if you could take a 30,000-foot view of the book, and we've talked about this tension between domestic women and the feminine goddess, could you say a little bit more about the overarching themes or insights or intrigues that this the Nine Nights present to the reader?
Yeah, so the overall, bridging all of them, I think that, again, the goal of the essay was to really get a breadth of the festival in which people could, who weren't familiar with the tradition, could really see that it's all over India. It's ubiquitous within South Asia, yet it can be radically different from one to the next. But the things that bridge them all are certain themes about, of course, there's the goddess, but there's certain themes about space and movement, because in each of the essays, there's always this relationship between people and how people move from one element to the next, with transitioning identities of space, whenever you go from being something that is, like, I'll just talk about my essay. It's about the court of the one of your kings in Mysore, in which, you know, at this moment, it's a public space. People are invited to the Darbar. It's a celebration. But as part of the celebration of the festival, the space transitions and the king goes into his living quarters. And so then it's also celebrated in a very domestic context. And in fact, in the text that I don't talk about in this book, but actually in my essay for the sequel to it that's being edited by Uta Huskin, Vasudha Narayan, and Astrid Zolter, Nine Nights of Power, about how people anticipate this movement of the king. And so it's Nine Nights of the Goddess is about, of course, performance of this festival, but it's also a way in which space is being defined through ritual performance. And so I think that is one of the overarching elements, is that in performance of this religious ritual, people are defining themselves, their own identity, and the spaces around them. And these identities shift constantly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. Now that you have made mention of it, tell us about this sequel.
Yeah, we're quite excited about it. The manuscript has been submitted to SUNY Press. So the same press that this book came out with, and I believe it's currently under review. And it's pretty much a follow-up by the same working group, Navratri Working Group, that was organized by Uta Huskin, first at University of Oslo, now at Heidelberg University, in which we're coming back now and looking specifically at material culture, visual culture, and how some of the same themes that we brought up are enacted in a way that's empowering to different people. So how human actors derive power from the celebration of this ritual.
So would that be more to the point of, say, the review you mentioned earlier, relating this to the Me Too movement, for example?
Yeah, I think that there's possibilities. Again, I'm not editing this one, so I've only seen my essay and heard a few presentations about them. But for mine, for instance, I'm actually, instead of talking about the colonial kingdom, I'm actually extending it forward to the contemporary celebration of Dasara and Mysore, and how politicians engage in the process of Dasara, and how this is a moment for them to display power, display hierarchy, and showing these connections between my primary research in the colonial period and how a lot of the same enactments of power and sovereignty now have been co-opted by elected politicians, which then complicates the idea of, you know, secular democracy and elected politicians, because often they're making a lot of the same claims that someone like Krishnaraja Whittier III had made in the 19th century.
So then, I have a question, but before the question, maybe just very briefly explain for our audience what Dasara is.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, this is another great thing about this book is it's called The Nine Nights of the Goddess, referring to directly to the name of the festival, the Navratri Festival, which is just the nine nights. But oftentimes, the largest celebration of the festival, it's not actually on during the nine nights. It's the 10th day. And so the 10th day has been called a lot of different things. The Jayadashami. Just Dashami, both referring to Vijayadashami, the 10th day of victory, And then in Mysore in Kannada, this becomes called Dasara. So the 10th day is when there's the largest celebration, typically in Mysore. And now in contemporary Mysore, it's a huge parade. Lots of people come and attend from all over the world. They have performances all leading into this large elephant procession to this Bani Montapam, where they have kind of like a show with like motorcycles and fireworks and planes and things. So actually, it winds up being a very huge show of Indian patriotism and Karnataka patriotism at the same time. But this 10th day is the really big day for the celebration.
It's a huge celebration on the 10th day of victory, very much related to the establishment, the consecration of sovereignty, kingship, leadership, governance. That theme goes way back from this 1500-year-old myth that I take a look at in the first chapter, where the goddess's role on a cosmic scale is to protect the throne of heaven. And so unsurprisingly, her festival is harnessed to invoke her for the sake of protecting, establishing sovereignty, kingship, leadership, governance on earth. Now, with that backdrop, still it's fascinating to me that we have elected secular leaders that are somehow participating in this ritual and this festival in this sacred sphere. And yeah, I'm sure you have tons to say, but maybe you can comment on that. Comment on that tension of, well, is there a sacred secular divide being played with here, or what's happening in terms of modern politics in this festival?
Yeah, so I mean, this, my thoughts on this all started whenever I was at the Dasara celebration. I guess this was in 2013, because it was before the very untimely and unfortunate death of the last Maharaja of Mysore, Srikantadatta Narasimha Raja Whittier. And so this was his last one, but I remember I was seated not very far away from him, and he had been, performing his duties as the Maharaja the entire 9 nights. Then when it came time for the actual Dasara parade, the one that's performed in front of literally thousands of people, he was just seated in sort of normal Western wear with a baseball cap on, and was looking, lack of a better word, kind of grumpy. And so I didn't really know what to expect, what was going to happen. But then when it came time to where the big culmination of this parade is that an elephant with this large golden Halda palanquin on its back with the goddess on it comes forward. And so from my textual studies of the colonial period and from looking at imagery of this, this is where the king would go up and do puja, as has been the case in, all of the Puranas. It's just the way that it's performed. The king does this. He remains seated, and instead the chief minister of Karnataka and the mayor of Mysore ascended up onto a platform and performed the puja. And so, of course, immediately this change in sovereignty, right? I could literally see the performance of his sovereignty at that moment, even though he had been holding the darbars, being proclaimed Maharaja every night in his public darbar. He's now seated, and the new sovereigns have taken the stage. And not only have they taken the stage, but they do a puja. They perform the puja, which then complicates, of course, this is always complicated, but the relationship between secular democracy and religion. So that got me thinking about, what does it mean to be elected? And in my own research for my first monograph, this is what I've been looking at, is in the colonial period, how people are, how they claim sovereignty, how they articulate it. And one of the modes is through this idea of election, but generally what we might call divine election, either being born into a lineage or having the favor of God or goddess. And then thinking about how does this transition in the context of India from divine election to popular election. And then so in this essay for the second volume that's coming out, I just sort of played around with those thoughts about how performing this ritual actually is performing a shift in sovereignty from something that would be, divinely elected to popularly elected, and where we can see the convergences between the textual descriptions of colonial Mysore and what I observed in 2013 in Mysore.
It seems to me, this is obviously quite fascinating, it seems to me that the lines, the distinction between sacred and profane, to use, you know, really somewhat dated religious studies terms, but you know, the lines between the sacred and the profane that we perceive in modern Western society, they seem fairly blurred in the Indian context, in the sense that while one may think that having an elected official perform the ritual renders the sacrality of the ritual profane, it seems that the inverse could be argued, in that this secular office nevertheless needs to be sanctified by the Devi, sanctified by the goddess. The goddess needs to protect governance, whether that's coming from the Maharaja or that's coming from the elected official. I mean, would you agree with this, or do you get a sense that the crowd is, that this is perfectly acceptable and normal, that this now secular office needs to be divinized, or do you find that there's a disjunction in that the secular has invaded the realm of the sacred?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and one that I don't think is lost on the Indian population, because actually right after this performance, I remember reading, and I don't know, you know, I'm assuming this happens every time, but unfortunately I'm not usually able to be in Mysore for Dussehra, but I remember in an op-ed in one of the local Mysore papers that sort of reflected on what would happen if the mayor of Mysore or the chief minister of Karnataka was Muslim. Would they be expected to perform the puja also? So, I mean, there's an understanding that this is clearly an enactment of Hindu identity within the election. But I think more broadly, I don't know if it's necessarily more so in India, but I think this is a tendency for a lot of people to look back to older modes of articulating sovereignty in election. Because, I mean, not very long ago, and I don't remember who it was, but I remember reading a news article or a headline about someone saying that you know, God had chosen Donald Trump to be the president of the United States, and that's why he was elected. So it actually, to me, just sort of that it's the very same thing that I was discussing in this, that, you know, this idea of popular election and divine election, they're still within a lot of people's mind, they're still completely intertwined, that power is, and sovereignty is something that comes from, you know, higher power, and it can just be bestowed on someone. So I think that it's still a complicated relationship that we find between these.
There certainly is, even in modern times, even when irrespective of one's political stance, even in modern times, for example, witnessing the State of the Union address, or irrespective of our views and what we agree with or disagree with, there definitely is this reverence and a sense of sacrality around the office of the presidency. You know, maybe the lines between the sacred and the profane aren't as blurred in even the American context as we'd like to think, but it becomes much more exasperated, or at least visible in the Indian context, where the elected official is literally performing a Hindu ritual in grand royal style on the 10th day after the Nine Nights Festival. So that's deeply fascinating. Well, I want to ask more about this monograph that you already mentioned. Maybe I'll save that till the end, but maybe one final question is, and I don't want it to be too much of a leading question, I want you to share sort of maybe what kind of surprised you, or where this project took you, or what you took away from it that intrigued you. And I imagine it must have been quite the journey and quite the learning experience for you. And you probably learned a lot, and even just by editing our colleagues' work. I certainly learned tremendously just reading what they had worked on. So maybe if you can comment for our listeners about, you know, what you took away from the project, or what really surprised you or intrigued you.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I learned a lot from it. I mean, that's the biggest takeaway, because I, you know, especially as you go through doing the research for your PhD, you get very much in a silo of your own thoughts, and people who are working on a very narrow topic, just as yourself. And I really was focused on Southern Karnataka. You know, anything north of the Vindhyas to me was like a completely universe away. And then I started working on this not long after I had gotten finished with my research for my PhD. And I was just sort of amazed by all of the different regions that people were discussing and the different ways that they were discussing it. So, I mean, it just like you go from things like reading Huskin's work on Tamil Nadu and this temple practice, which then ties back to Vijayanagara. And then you transition to someone like Zinya Zeiler's looking at Facebook groups and how they do Durga Puja. So I also, I mean, even though I knew about Navratri being celebrated everywhere, the diversity of ways that it's celebrated and how technology has changed the celebration from the medieval period within the medieval period, and then new things like WhatsApp and Facebook, how they're continuing to make the change. I mean, it just really impressed upon me really the need for a book like this, because it's really easy to read like the Kalika Purana and say, oh, this is how Navratri is supposed to be celebrated. And then you pick up this book and you realize that, you know, people are in large WhatsApp groups and sharing images of their Durga Puja from Calcutta to Mumbai, or you have people going to see a Baba in Delhi who's giving spiritual discourses. There's just such a variety of the ways that people engage with this festival that I never knew personally, and I was delighted to be able to be involved in editing the volume and really getting to get in deep with all of this, and just really being able to appreciate the varieties of the nine nights of the goddess.
Yeah, the power of this festival, it's so incredibly mind-bogglingly pervasive and pan-Indic. And at first glance, one is like, well, how can anything be so pervasively pan-Indic? When you take a closer look, it's so variegated in its manifestations, mm-hmm. that it fits into really every crevice, every state, every milieu, whether that's social media, whether that's a ritual sphere, whether that's a political sphere. And so I think I'll take myself out of the equation for a minute, but looking at my colleagues' work and the job that you guys have done, it seems to be really a gift to modern scholarship. It's really illuminating on the potency and the variety of this very important Hindu festival. So thank you very much for your efforts.
Bringing it was my pleasure.
Bringing this, you know, and unearthing this, or putting this together. Now, we've taken enough of your time for one day on this Friday afternoon, when I'm sure you have many things to wrap up. So why don't you just tell our listeners what's next, what you're working on now?
Yeah, so I luckily, I just had a manuscript accepted for publication with Oxford University Press that ought to come out sometime, hopefully in the fall. And the title of that is Devotional Sovereignty, Kingship and Religion in India, 1782 to 1868. And so in this book, it's back to a lot of the themes that I've already been discussing, but it's looking at two different kings during the sort of burgeoning British presence in southern Karnataka, the first being Tipu Sultan, who was a Muslim king, and the next being Krishnaraja Woodier III, who is a Hindu king. And looking at the beginning of sort of the British incursion into Mysore, with Tipu Sultan being very successful militaristically in holding them off, and looking at all the products of his court in which he articulates his sovereignty and how his sovereignty has been authorized. And so you find things about him being a great warrior, God choosing him because he's the best of all the possible rulers, and then how this slowly transitions as he starts to lose battles, and then eventually loses power, has to sign a pretty awful treaty in 1792, and then eventually his death in 1799, and sort of how it changes about articulations of sovereignty. So specifically, as he loses military and administrative power, how he turns to what I call religious vocabulary, talking about his direct connection to the lineage going back to the Prophet Muhammad, how he talks about his devotion to Sufi peers, to Hindu gurus, how he enacts this devotion, and then on into the Hindu period where the British are administering Mysore, how this sort of rhetoric is even amplified even further by connecting the Hindu king to a descendant of Vishnu, tracing his lineage all the way down by a great project of the court to express him as the ideal devotee by installing images of himself in temples and commissioning paintings and lithographs of him performing puja and disseminating these out across the kingdom. And so I look at all of this to be able to sort of look at how articulations of sovereignty in India change as Indian kingship itself starts to unravel and be subjugated underneath British colonialism.
So it seems we end with how we started, which is talking about the goddess and the king. We have been talking with Dr. Caleb Simmons, assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Arizona, one of the three editors of this wonderful book, Nine Nights of the Goddess, the Navaratri Festival in South Asia, by SUNY Press. Caleb, it's been a delight talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
So we will sign off now. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my scholarly background at rajbalkaran.com. And until next time, well.